Last week, I introduced our series on the book of Esther and gave us an overview of this portion of Scripture. And this morning, we're jumping right into chapter 1 and plan to more or less cover a chapter a week. And glad for the opportunity to get into the details of this wonderful and this powerful story. And so I trust that you're there open to Esther chapter 1. But I want to begin by reading something else today. And you'll recognize it probably right away, a familiar story that makes a humorous point that has a lot to do with what we're considering in Esther chapter 1. Many years ago, there was an emperor who was so very fond of new clothes that he spent all his money on them. He did not trouble about his soldiers. He did not care to go to the theater. He only went out when he had the chance to show off his new clothes. He had a different suit for each hour of the day. Most kings can be found sitting in council. It was said of the emperor, he is sitting in his wardrobe. One day, two fellows calling themselves weavers came to town. They said that they knew how to weave cloth of the most beautiful colors and patterns. The clothes made from this wonderful cloth would be invisible to everyone who was unfit for the job he held or who was very simple in character. These must indeed be splendid clothes, said the emperor. If I had such a suit, I might at once find out what men in my kingdom are unfit for their job. I would be able to tell the wise men from the foolish. This stuff must be woven for me immediately. We gave large sums of money to both the weavers in order that they might begin their work at once. So the two pretend weavers set up looms. They worked very busily, though in reality they did nothing at all. They asked for the finest silk and the purest gold thread. They put both into their own knapsacks. Then they pretended to work at the empty looms until late at night. I should like to know how the weavers are getting on with my cloth, said the emperor to himself one day, when he remembered that a simpleton, or one unfit for his job, would be unable to see the cloth. He began to worry. To be sure, he thought he was safe. However, he would prefer sending somebody else to bring him news about the weavers and their work. All the people in the kingdom had heard of the wonderful cloth. All were eager to learn how wise or how foolish their neighbors might be. I will send my faithful old wise man to the weaver, said the emperor at last. He will be best able to see how the cloth looks. He's a man of sense. No one can be better for his job than he is. So the faithful old wise man went into the hall where the thieves were working with all their might at their empty looms. What can be the meaning of this? Thought the old man, opening his eyes very wide. I cannot find the least bit of thread on the looms. However, he did not say his thoughts aloud. The thieves asked him very kindly to be so good as to come nearer their looms. Then they asked him whether the cloth pleased him. They asked whether the colors were not very beautiful. All the time they were pointing to the empty frames. The poor old wise man looked and looked. He could not see anything on the looms for a very good reason. There was nothing there. What, thought he again, is it possible that I am a fool? I've never thought so myself. No one must know it now if I am so. Can it be that I am unfit for my job? No, the emperor must not know that either. I will never tell that I could not see the stuff. Well, sir, said one of the weavers, still pretending to work, you do not say whether the cloth pleases you. Oh, it is excellent, replied the old wise man, looking at the loom through his spectacles. This pattern and the colors, yes, I will tell the emperor without delay how very beautiful I think them. We shall be much obliged to you, said the thieves. Then they named the many colors and described the pattern of the pretended stuff. The old wise man listened with care to their words so he might repeat them to the emperor. The thieves asked for more silk and gold, saying it was necessary to complete what they had begun. Once again, they put all that was given them into their knapsacks. They went on working with as much effort as before at their empty looms. And the same thing happened again when the emperor sends another man from his court to check out the work. And the story goes on. Finally, the emperor himself wished to see the costly material while it was still in the loom. He took many officers of the court and the two honest men who had already admired the cloth. As soon as the weaver saw the emperor approach, they went on working faster than ever, although they still did not pass even one thread through the looms. Is not the work absolutely magnificent? said the two officers of the crown, "If your majesty will only be pleased to look at it, what a splendid design, what glorious colors." And at the same time, they pointed to the empty frames, for they imagined that everyone else could see this exquisite piece of workmanship. "How is this?" said the emperor to himself. "I can see nothing. This is indeed a terrible affair. Am I a simpleton, or am I unfit to be an emperor? That would be the worst thing that could happen." "Oh, the cloth is charming," said he aloud. "I approve of it completely." He smiled most graciously and looked closely at the empty looms. No way would he say that he would not see what two of his advisors had praised so much. Everyone with the emperor now strained his or her eyes, hoping to discover something on the looms, but they could see no more than the others. Nevertheless, they all exclaimed, "Oh, how beautiful!" and advised his majesty to have some new clothes made from this splendid material for the parade that was planned. "Magnificent, charming, excellent," was called out on all sides. And so the day for the parade came. The emperor, with all the grandees of his court, came to the weavers. The thieves raised their arms as if in the act of holding something up. "Here are your majesty's trousers. Here is the scarf. Here is the mantle. The whole suit is as light as a cobweb. One might fancy one has nothing at all on when dressed in it." "Yes, indeed," said all the courtiers, although not one of them could see anything of this special cloth. The emperor was undressed for a fitting, and the thieves pretended to array him in his new suit. The emperor turned round and from side to side before the looking glass. "How splendid his majesty looks in his new clothes, and how well they fit," everyone cried out. "What a design! What colors! These are indeed royal robes." "I am quite ready," said the emperor. He appeared to be examining his handsome suit. The lords of the bedchamber, who were to carry his majesty's train, felt about on the ground as if they were lifting up the ends of the mantle. Then they pretended to be carrying something, for they would by no means want to appear foolish or not fit for their jobs. The emperor walked under his high canopy in the midst of the procession through the streets of his capital. All the people standing by and those at the windows cried out, "Oh, how beautiful are our emperor's new clothes! What a magnificent train there is to the mantle, and how gracefully the scarf hangs!" No one would admit these much admired clothes could not be seen, because in doing so, he would have been saying he was either a simpleton or unfit for his job. "But the emperor has nothing at all on," said a little child. "Listen to the voice of the child," exclaimed his father. What the child had said was whispered from one to another. "But he has nothing at all on," at last cried out all the people. The emperor was upset, for he knew the people were right. However, he thought, the procession must go on now. The lords of the bedchamber took greater pains than ever to appear holding up a train, although in reality there was no train to hold, and the emperor walked on in his underwear. Well, that, of course, was Hans Christian Andersen's The Emperor's New Clothes. And you may know that that tale is based on a medieval Spanish story, and yet we also know that Andersen changed the ending from what it originally was, where it was simply a crowd admiring the emperor's new clothes, to someone in the crowd, a child, beginning to question what was going on and saying that he actually had no clothes, and the people realizing that that was the case. Well, there are theories about what Andersen was thinking and why he changed the end especially. Here's one theory. Quote, he once recalled standing in a crowd with his mother, waiting to see King Frederick VI, and when the king made his appearance, Andersen cried out, "Oh, he's nothing more than a human being." His mother then tried to silence him, saying, "Have you gone mad, child?" Well, this kind of thing makes for stories that children enjoy, but it's believed that there was more than just a child's tale involved, but that actually Andersen wrote that story to satirize the vanity of the uppity classes of Denmark where he carried out his work. When we come to this first chapter of Esther, what we're reading is actually a kind of Jewish version of the emperor has no clothes. We don't want to make too much of this scene. We don't want to be looking for application in every one of its details because, as I pointed out last week, this chapter is not the main story. It's actually the introduction to the story of Esther. It's here mostly to set the stage for the real plot of the book. And the plot of the book doesn't really have to do with Esther or emperors. It has to do with God's mighty providential deliverance of his people. And yet, as an introduction, this chapter presents to us one of the main human characters in the story. He is the Persian Emperor Ahasuerus. We know him better by his Greek name, Xerxes. And through him, we see something of what it was that the people of God in exile were up against. The Jewish people were dominated by a massive political force that did not share their worldview and that could, on a whim, turn its immense power against them. That was the kind of unstable and threatening environment that they lived in. And when you're in that kind of situation as someone belonging to the people of God, you could naturally become confused about how the ambitious and petulant ways of your authorities fit into the sovereign rule of Yahweh, the one true and only God. Living in this environment, the Jewish people could easily question the promises of God and lose heart about the future and the plan of God for them. Don't you feel that way sometimes as well? As you look at the world in which we as believers live in today? Well, Esther chapter 1 is designed to begin renewing our faith, even in the middle, and especially in the middle of those kinds of situations. It not only satirizes the godless world system, but it helps us see how a sovereign God uses the foolishness of men to set up his plan to bless his people. And so this morning, we're going to walk through this chapter and see how it does point, ultimately, to divine providence. But as it begins, it actually seems to point in the opposite direction. It's not initially about God. You couldn't tell that by reading, especially the first section, because what it looks like is that man is very much in charge. These opening verses don't talk about the kingdom of God. They talk about the kingdom of man, and to the human eye, it looks very impressive. As we look at verses 1 to 9, I think we could summarize it this way: opulence advertises human power. Opulence advertises human power. Look with me at verse 1. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. And let's stop there again to get this sense of the picture that the narrator is painting for us of the impressiveness of this kingdom. In fact, I want to show you a map of that. Here is a map that gives us an idea of what the Medo-Persian Empire would have looked like at this time. And the text says, from India to Ethiopia, using the ancient names and borders, in our terms today, we're talking about a swath of land that covered from Pakistan all the way to northern Sudan. You're looking at that map and that pink area there, you're talking about over 2 million square miles. And it's estimated that in that land, at this time, would have lived almost half of the world's population. The Medo-Persian Empire was the largest empire up to this time in history. And in terms of the people involved, the people under domination, it may have been the largest ever, even down to our day. And it talks about 127 provinces. Those wouldn't have been the larger sections of the geography that are known by the name of a satrapy. The provinces here seem to be talking about smaller units, where you have a significant city and there is a large region of land surrounding it. And probably the author chose to give us that number, the larger one, to give us a sense of, again, the vastness of the empire that Xerxes controlled. And then look at what it says in verse 2. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel. And let's get a sense of where that is. You can kind of see it on this map, but here is more of a close-up of what we're talking about. And actually, this empire was so great that the Persians established four capital cities, all of which you see on this map. You have the city of Babylon in the west, the city of Ecbatana in the north, the city of Persepolis in the southeast, and right in the middle is Susa, the one that Esther is discussing. And it was known as a place where the emperor and his court would spend the winters especially, and a place of great glory and majesty, as we're going to see. Verse 3 goes on to say that in the third year of his reign, Xerxes gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. It's helpful to put this in connection with what else we know from extra-biblical history about Xerxes. His father Darius had attempted to stretch out the Persian Empire even further, particularly to the west, and to conquer the people of Greece. But we know from history that he was defeated at the city of Athens. He did not succeed in that ambition that he has. And so Xerxes comes on the throne, and he takes up the cause that his father had failed in. We read here that this was during his third year. That was the year 483 BC. And what we also know from history is that during that year, Xerxes held a war council to prepare for his own invasion of Greece. And it's generally believed among scholars that the feast that Esther is describing is the same as the war council. In other words, it was a sort of a working meeting, but it was a time of great celebration and a time of great indulgence and a time of great hospitality on the part of Xerxes. And look at how verse 4 describes what Xerxes was putting on display for people. Look at this redundant language that is used to emphasize the effort that he's making to wow them with all that he has to offer. Verse 4, he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. That language is deliberately employed here to emphasize the majesty of the kingdom of Xerxes. You're talking about a six-month political convention slash party going on. And the point wasn't just to impress people or simply to give them a good time, but to convince them that he had the resources to fight Greece and to assure them that he would reward them handsomely as they joined up with him in that effort, fighting alongside of him. In other words, it wasn't a mere show of wealth and hedonism. The wealth conveyed power. I'm in charge. I have all of this might. I have all of these resources. The wealth was designed to advertise his political power. And then we move on to verse 5. When these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. As if 9 months or 6 months, the 180 days, had not been enough, now you have a 7-day sort of follow-up party to the party. And it includes everybody in Susa, regardless of their social status. Perhaps part of the motivation was to thank the local people for the help that they'd offered to put on that other 6-month event. And what follows about this second party is just extraordinary. In fact, apart from the description of the tabernacle and the temple, what we're looking at here in the next few verses is the Old Testament's most detailed description of a physical setting, of a location or a building or the place where an event takes place. The sort of thing that you would see, the kind of royal glory that you would witness if you were taking a tour of Buckingham Palace or Versailles, and listen to what the narrator chooses to record here. First of all, verse 6 about the decorations. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars. And the seating, it was on couches of gold and silver. And the flooring, this was on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, precious stones. In our language, millions upon millions of dollars worth of these accoutrements to display royal power. And then down to the smallest thing of even the glasses that the people were using to drink. The drinkware is described in verse 7. The drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds. In other words, each goblet, gold though they all were, each one was individually designed and crafted. These were not produced, mass-produced on an assembly line. These were objects of art individually in and of themselves. And then the passage goes on to describe the drinking itself. And the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. An abundance of wine was available. And the only rule about drinking on that occasion was that there were no rules. Each man could do whatever he wanted. He could drink as little or as much as he desired. And so there is this emphasis on self-determination, each person following the desires of his own heart. That emphasis, that idea of self-determination, captures well the main point of this scene about power. Xerxes himself can do whatever he wants, and everyone else is acting under his authority. He's the one in charge. He's in control. He holds sway over this empire, and even down to what they were drinking. This is the mighty emperor. That's the message of this party. And yet, a perceptive reader might have a question at this point. With all of this business about being in control and ruling and making decisions, the fact is that when people get drunk, they really aren't in charge. They are under the influence of a liquid that ends up controlling them, that impedes their thinking, and that moves them to do things that they normally wouldn't do. And how will that play out in this passage? The reader might also be wondering what was going on with the women of Susa at this time. Because in verse 8, when it says at the end, to do as each man desired, the word man there refers to the males, and so what about the women? And the next verse, verse 9, answers that question. It says, Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. And that mention of the queen serves as a transition to the next scene. And as you're thinking now about the women, what's going to happen quickly is that the story is going to take a surprising direction. There in the first scene, the emphasis was this: opulence advertises human power. What we see as we go on to the next scene in verses 10 to 12 is that domination of one person over another, domination exposes human foolishness. Let's read from verse 10 down to the beginning of verse 12. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, and that speaks to the question I brought up a moment ago, it confirms that alcohol was a factor in what is about to take place. When the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus. So again, in keeping with all this opulence and all these displays of power, there's this impressive entourage of seven officials that adds to the sort of pompousness of the scene. And here's what he commanded them to do in verse 11, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But, verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. What was this all about? This is kind of strange from our vantage point. And in terms of inspired explanation, what I read to you is all the information that we have. And so we can't be dogmatic about exactly what was going on or what Xerxes was thinking or what Vashti was thinking. But here are various ideas that commentators have suggested. The most positive spin on this situation is the following from one commentator. Quote, perhaps the sight of the queen in her royal glory was intended to inspire patriotism and loyalty as public appearances of the British queen today. And so we understand that politicians will often put on display their wives in general just as a way of attracting people to their own wisdom or power or whatever, and it has this feeling of inspiring positive thoughts toward the ruler. That's the most positive spin I think you could put on it. Maybe Xerxes was wanting her to parade around as a further and even climactic display of his own glory and his own power, not just a sort of well-meaning patriotism, but more of a narcissistic promotion of his wife, as if to say, here's my trophy wife. This is how great I am. And the worst case scenario is the possibility that something lewd was involved in what he wanted her to do. In fact, if you look at the statement there about his command, it says to bring Queen Vashti before the king with a royal crown. According to some of the rabbis, that crown was the only thing that she was supposed to wear. And this would have been a very immoral situation. We don't really know. Regardless of the explanation, common sense would tell us that Xerxes' request was not the best idea. Not the way to treat a woman, no matter what his thinking was about his kingdom. Even if he did not have some kind of immoral motive in mind, it seems like the least he could have done was to have a personal conversation with her instead of sending a small army to command her and to fetch her. It shouldn't really surprise us that he took the approach that he did. Xerxes was acting like pagan emperors acted. But to the Jewish reader, again, remember, this story was written to the people of God, and they had a certain background, and they had certain understanding of God's ways, including God's ways about marriage. To the Jewish reader, Xerxes' behavior would have been understood as domineering and as abusive, entirely contrary to the tenderness and the considerateness of the one flesh marriage relationship that is taught by the Hebrew Bible. The Jewish reader would also expect that this was probably not going to turn out well for Xerxes. And so we come to what it says in verse 12, where Vashti refuses. We also don't know the exact reason that she refused. But here again are some possibilities. I mentioned earlier about the extra-biblical history. Probably most of what we know about this period outside the Bible is from the Greek historian Herodotus. And Herodotus mentions that Xerxes had a wife by the name of Amestris. Of course, Xerxes would have been involved with multiple women. But we know from Herodotus, according to him, he had a wife by the name of Amestris. And it is possible that that is actually another name for this same woman, Vashti. If so, here's what's interesting. At this time, one of the other things we know is that Amestris was pregnant with Xerxes' son, Artaxerxes, who was going to end up being the next emperor. And if Amestris and Vashti are the same person, as many people believe, this is really not the ideal time for this woman to be trying to put on a beauty show. That's a possibility of why she refused. It may have been just the general concept that in that culture it was considered inappropriate for a woman to show up in a feast that was supposed to be only for men. It may have been as well that she just didn't want to be objectified into a mere symbol of the state, as though all she was good for was to serve as another decoration to advertise the glory of the emperor. And if it was that worst case lewd scenario that I mentioned, this woman, I don't think, would have wanted to be humiliated by being gawked at by a bunch of intoxicated men. Whatever the case, whatever her motivation, the point of this incident isn't to answer all the interesting questions that we might have. And I'm not going to give some kind of dogmatic explanation on all those different theories, or even get into the question that people often wonder about, you know, did Vashti do the right thing? Should she have gone along as a submissive wife, or did she do the right thing to resist? You can take that up with your friends and family over lunch. It's not the point of this incident to get into those details. The point is simply that she did not accede to the command, and that her response challenged Xerxes' whole objection for his elaborate parties. Her refusal, it undermined the idea that, in fact, he was the one in charge. I mean, here's this emperor amassing an army to invade Greece, and he couldn't even get his wife to do what he said. What kind of confidence does that give you in his royal authority and his wisdom for carrying out his purposes or for making decisions? Xerxes' request was foolish to begin with, and the outcome made him look like an even bigger fool. And that's the point I'm making here from this scene, that attitude of domination, it exposed his foolishness. Domination exposes human folly. And that is going to become even more apparent as the story concludes in scene 3, which picks up at the end of verse 12 and all the way down to the end of the chapter in verse 22. And here's my summary of those verses. We have seen that opulence advertises human power, that domination exposes human foolishness, and now number 3, that overreaction displays human weakness. Let's read verses 12 to 22. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. Here's what he said to them. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti? Because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's behavior, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So, when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. What do we see in that development? And how do we explain, how do we interpret what is being said here? I want to point out several issues. First of all, that for all his power and all his supposed wisdom as a ruler, Xerxes is very reliant on his advisors. And we're going to see that more than once as we read the story of Esther. This man here doesn't make a proposal. He doesn't throw an idea out on the table and ask the men what they think. He asked them to make a proposal. And the text says that this was his standard operating procedure. And the more you read the book of Esther, you start to get the feeling that given that dynamic, given that leadership style, it doesn't take too much to manipulate the great emperor, to get him to do what you want him to do, and that's actually going to happen more than once in this book. So that raises questions about what's happening here. And then you start to read about the seven eunuchs, and all of those hard-to-pronounce names are listed, just like they were listed when it came to the eunuchs. And again, this adds to this sense of all these mighty and wise people that surround the king. There were seven eunuchs before, and now there are seven advisors. They're led by a man named Memucan. And let's consider the advice that he gives. In general, it seems to me to be over the top. He's actually suggesting that Vashti's behavior is going to upend marriages throughout the entire Persian realm. Really? Was that a realistic possibility? What if many of the women and the men questioned whether Xerxes should have even issued the command in the first place? Maybe Memucan is just appealing to Xerxes' ego with this emphasis on exerting your authority over people. Look at the way that some of this phraseology is made. You notice that in verse 20, when he's talking about the decree going out, so when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, etc., etc. That seems to be an appeal to ego, and he knew, Xerxes knew that his kingdom was vast. This man is lavishing all this terminology, it seems, to appeal to his ego. And then what seems to be a comical statement at the end of verse 22, I think this is the right way to understand the wording here at the end, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. What is that talking about, this language of his people comment? Well, as you might imagine, in a kingdom so vast where there was all this international communication and travel, that you ended up with some ethnically mixed marriages. We know that that happened even among the Jews, which was a problem that we read about in Ezra and Nehemiah. Inter-ethnic marriages in that case, because you're talking about one side being loyal to Yahweh and another side not being. There was a real spiritual problem that was being addressed, not really an ethnic problem so much. But in any case, this would have been going on throughout the kingdom. And so you end up with one person who grew up with one language and another person who grew up in another language. And so whose language is going to be spoken? Whose language is going to be taught to the children? And I don't know why Memucan threw this in. But what he's saying is that we need to make sure that the men of each household is so in charge that we have to insist, you've got to speak the language of the husband. There's no bending about that. And it is comical to think of, you know, each man now receiving this decree, going to his wife and saying, I'm the one in charge here, and you're going to talk my language too. Not allowed to talk your language. The whole thing seems over the top and unnecessary. Think about this as well. When you consider that Memucan brought up the possibility that this event was going to have this wide ranging impact on marriages all over the place. I infer from that Mamukin and the men generally must have suffered from major insecurity about their place and their role in their homes, that the only way that they could feel comfortable or like everything was as it should be was for everybody empire-wide to make this massive show of force sponsored by a decree of the king. They must have been pretty insecure in their positions. And furthermore, consider this, that the plan is self-defeating. I mean, basically, if we could put it in our terms, the concern is that, first of all, Xerxes is going to have a PR problem on his hand, that people are going to perceive him to be weak, and then there's going to be a spillover effect on these other marriages. So he's concerned that word is going to get out about how Vashti defied him. Well, I have a hard time imagining that the word was going to get out that broadly as it would with an empire-wide decree that would guarantee that everybody out there in those 2 million square miles would know of the king's embarrassment. And his embarrassment would become much wider known than if he would just have tried to deal with this with Vashti and within the context of the people that were actually there. Really, if you think about it, that decree is not going to help his image. That he is having to admit to the empire as a whole of the problem that he had with his wife. And ultimately, even though he is making the show of force with his decree, that still didn't change the fact that the original command he gave to Vashti accomplished nothing. That she refused to obey him and go along with his wishes. So if she was able to disobey him to his face in front of all those people, who's to say that this decree, this other command that he's sending out to all the other women in the empire is going to accomplish anything as well? We have already been exposed in such a humiliating way to the inefficacy of Xerxes' word. How does he know that his decree is going to really make a difference? And so with those kinds of things in mind, one commentator said this: the ruling class of Persia is depicted not so much as the Magnificent Seven, but more like Ahasuerus and the Seven Dwarfs. I think that really is the impression the author wants us to take away from this. And it's an example of satire. What is satire? Satire is a form of literature that is addressing what may be a very serious topic, but it's doing so in such a way as to poke fun of elements related to that topic so you can see how ridiculous they really are. And in some cases, to realize that they really shouldn't be taken seriously. That they're really not the threat that they appear. That really is the case with something like Hans Christian Andersen's The Emperor's New Clothes. He is mocking the emperor and all his court and even people in the kingdom at large because of how vain they were and how proud they were that they did not want to admit that there really was no clothes. He is challenging the vanity of his own contemporaries through that story. And you would be familiar with other forms of satire in our culture as well. In fact, if I can give you some examples without endorsing them and without offending you, just to try to make this point. You have something, if this is going to date me a little bit, but some of you would be familiar with the television series Hogan's Heroes. And even though there were some really problematic elements in that story, ultimately what was going on in that series? You're talking about a very serious issue of the German treatment of their prisoners of war during World War II. But according to the TV show, it was all about making them look like they were buffoons and didn't know what they were doing. It was really a kind of a slap in the face to them. It was a way of mocking the fact that they had lost the war, right? It was a cultural statement that way through satire. And more to our day, this goes on almost every day through a website called the Babylon Bee, where they're taking some serious issue. It could be in the world of religion, it could be in the world of politics, and they're presenting it in a funny light, an ironic light, to poke fun at ridiculous things that people believe and do. Really putting people down to size with the satire that they are writing. And it's a pretty effective way of making a point and of even humbling people that need to be humbled. Sometimes ourselves, we need to be willing to laugh at the foolishness that sometimes we engage in. That's the sort of thing that you're reading here in Esther chapter 1. And in fact, as we read this chapter and how it is challenging and questioning the power and the skill of the Persian Empire that will soon be arrayed against the people of God as this story goes on, I think the original readers of Esther would have gotten the point maybe even more than we get the point. Why? Because they knew what happened with that invasion that Xerxes was planning. And the fact that 3 years after Esther 1 happened, the invasion of Greece, though initially it looked to be successful, ended up in humiliating failure for Xerxes. And that was already history by the time that people were reading the book of Esther. They understood where this was all going, that in the end, all of this glory and power of Xerxes didn't accomplish the goal that he desired. He really wasn't the mighty figure that he thought he was and that he was portraying himself to be. His overreaction, specifically in these verses, it displays his weakness. And so even though the story begins by making him look so impressive, as you look at the way that it unfolds, and especially if you know some of that little bit later history, you're just laughing at yourself at what's happening and where this is probably all going to go, even in this book, if you haven't read the rest of it. So it makes him ultimately look bad. On the positive side, if you walk away and you're saying to yourself, you know what, Xerxes really isn't this mighty figure that he claims to be. You're saying to yourself, well, maybe somebody else is. If he's not king, then who is? If he's not in control, who is ruling over the affairs of men, even over this incident? And the providence of God in this chapter, even though it's subtle and it's just introductory to the overall book of Esther, it is there nevertheless. In fact, I want to give you this other quote from a commentator. With his one decision to display Vashti at his war council, Xerxes set in motion a chain of events that culminates in the deliverance of God's people, fulfilling the promise of the ancient covenant made ages before in a faraway place. And then moving on to some application, the author goes on to say, like Xerxes of old, like Xerxes of long ago, modern kings, presidents, and rulers make decisions from purely political motives. Like Vashti, people unwittingly make decisions that have long-reaching consequences far beyond what they could have foreseen. These events may be completely secular and perhaps made by people who give Christ no thought. Nonetheless, through them, God is moving all of history forward to accomplish all that must happen before the return of His Son, Jesus Christ, the true King of Kings. And so here you have this supposedly mighty secular pagan authority, an emperor, and he makes one decision that was foolish to start with. And all that unraveled as a result ended up creating a situation where, as we come to the next chapter, in the providence of God, somebody else is going to step in to the right place at the right time to carry out in God's hands the deliverance needed at that moment by the people of God. Well, need to wrap this up. How would we summarize the theme of this chapter? I could put it this way. The powers that threaten God's people are not as great as they appear, and God uses them to work out our deliverance. Things are not always as they appear. I was reminded of this just a few days ago when I needed to go to the bank to make a deposit, and I drive up to the window and I give the money and so forth to the teller, and I'm sitting there and I look over and I see him shuffling the money and the deposit slip and so forth, looking it up on the computer and thinking to myself, what is taking so long? This is just a little bit of cash, and he seems to be taking forever. What's the problem here? Here I was judging the teller in my mind that he was making a mistake or didn't know what he was doing or something like that. And after a little bit of that, he talks to me and he says, we don't find you in our system. This is actually for Bank of America. And that's not where I was. I was at another bank. Bank of America was right next door. I had driven up to this one bank, in my defense, because I had actually made a deposit there for somebody else who did have an account there. But that was not my bank. And here I was getting a little bit upset or judgmental toward this teller, and things were not what they appeared to be. I was the one in the wrong. And often in life, things are not as they appear, and when we judge by sight, we can often end up judging incorrectly, especially if we are judging God and His ways and His providence and His decisions for what He brings into our lives. And what this chapter tells us is that things are not always as they appear. The world is not as in control as it comes across. We are not in a losing position as we might be made to feel. The powers that threaten God's people are not as great as they appear, and God uses them to work out our deliverance. We're going to see that kind of thing again and again in this book of Esther, but I want to leave you with a few quick application thoughts that we're also going to develop as we get more into the story. If that is true, that the powers that threaten God's people are not as great as they appear, and God uses them to work out our deliverance, what does that mean for us? Well, here's one thing it means. Don't become cynical when it seems like God's promises are not being fulfilled. Don't judge Him as though He didn't know what He was talking about, as though He couldn't come through. Don't become cynical. Number two as well, don't become anxious. Don't live in fear and frustration about what's going to happen next. What's going to happen next may be as wonderful as what you go on to read in the book of Esther. Here's an interesting thought. Don't accommodate. Sometimes when we see that the Lord is seemingly taking a long time, or we don't understand what He's doing, and the world seems so big and so powerful and so in control, we might just give up. And have the attitude, if you can't beat them, join them. Because it looks more immediately rewarding. And that would have been a huge mistake for God's people. And in this story, we're being challenged against that kind of response because things are not always as they appear. And then finally, wait for the story to unfold. We have not seen the end of the story. We haven't seen the next chapter, even of Esther, or the next purpose that God has in store for each of our lives or for His church as a whole. And this book is a book about waiting on the providence and the timing of God. And so I encourage you to live by faith and not by sight.